Thank you, Dr. Owens, and thank you, Dr. Buchanan. And you have your paper in front of you. This is a unique experience because much of it on a faculty lecture is read. And so I'm looking forward to doing that. The topic for today is, what does a woman need and want from you? Now, consequently, the audience I have in mind is male and also married. And yet, I think, I know if I look back in my days when I was in seminary, I was single, the opportunity to learn about marriage and family life from God's Word was probably one of the most foundational elements in my education, and I appreciated it very much. The topic I've chosen for today, what does a woman need and want from you? I am going to be answering the question from the Song of Solomon, chapters 1 through 8. I'll be moving through the book, not in necessarily a progressive order, although I'll be ending with a passage in chapter 8. My goal is to give you a means of understanding the book and hopefully adding it to a text and a series of texts that you can use in your ministries as well. I'm going to be doing three things, and let me give those to you right off at the beginning. First, I'll present some general observations on the book itself. Second, because the Song of Solomon explores the relationship between a man and a woman, I'll present the qualities that make a close relationship possible. The Song of Solomon, of course, if you've read it, and hopefully you have a number of times, is almost shocking in its detail. There will be no shocks and surprises today, because what I'm going to be presenting are the qualities that we see in the text that make a very close and intimate relationship possible. My focus, though, is going to be on the man's part, and hence our topic for today, what does a woman need and consequently want from you? As with any book of the Bible, the longer we read it, the larger it grows. My lecture for today is only an introduction to a very beautiful book. But first, some general observations. Observation number one, the Song of Solomon is about a king who loves a beautiful maiden from the country. They become husband and wife, brother and sister, friend and lover. Most English versions of the Bible give the Song of Solomon as a title, but in the Hebrew, it's the Song of Songs, or literally, the best of all the songs. We know from 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 32 that Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs were 1,005. What we have before us today is the best of the 1,005. In Solomon's eyes, it was, to use the words of Franz Delitzsch, the most praiseworthy, most excellent, and most highly treasured among the songs. Observation number two. The Song of Songs has been placed among the great wisdom books of the Bible. And just as Job examines suffering, Ecclesiastes studies the purpose of life, and Proverbs sets forth wisdom in all forms of human relationships and endeavors, the song explores marital love. Observation number three. The purpose, then, of the Song of Songs is this: to show the high value and hidden beauty of a virtuous man and a virtuous woman in love. Or to put it more simply, the song shows what a loving relationship between a good man and a good woman looks like. The book is, in the words of evangelical scholars such as Walter Kaiser, Derek Kidner, G. Lloyd Carr, a commentary on Genesis chapter 2 and verses 24 through 25. For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Observation number four. The Song of Songs, then, is the full development of themes Solomon presents in his other two books. In Proverbs 5:18, he says, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in or with the wife of your youth." And again in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 9 and verse 9, his major conclusion is to fear God and keep his commandments while you're still young. Another positive conclusion he makes in chapter 9 and verse 9, enjoy life with the woman whom you love, for this is your reward in life. Observation number five, Solomon arranges his song into three parts. There is anticipation, marriage, and mature love. First, the anticipation of marriage, where we meet a young couple together in mutual admiration and mutual longing. Pre-marriage. The second part of the book involves the marriage itself. We see the couple happily joined, but facing conflict. But once reconciled, they share an even higher regard for one another. And that is one of the great truths about reconciliation in marriage. It produces a higher regard for the individual than before the conflict ever happened. And then finally, the third part of the book, we view mature love. The couple grows closer in affection and more determined to remain as one. Perhaps a major observation that should be made, I would give this as observation number six, is that the book, the more we become familiar with it, the more, if married, we enjoy our spouse, the more we see the relationship between Christ and the church. And I'll be commenting on that at the end of my presentation here. Moving from our general observations, let me get to the second point. Moving from our general observations, and since we're looking at a close relationship between a man and a woman, the second thing I want to do here is to explore the qualities in a man and a woman that make a close relationship possible. Or in other words, for a marriage to succeed at its highest level, what does a man need from a woman, and what does a woman need from a man? Because it's not our topic for today, I won't say much about what a man needs from a woman, but I will give you the two qualities we see in the Song of Songs. They are the rare and beautiful qualities that make or mark a true woman. They are humility and strength. When the two are brought together by the Spirit of God in the heart of a woman, they become a priceless gift for the fortunate man who finds her. This brings us then to our topic for today. Remember that the Song of Songs shows us what a loving relationship between a good man and a good woman looks like. So because of the way she's been made by God, what does a woman need and consequently want from you? First, strong character. She wants to admire you. If you would, turn to the Song of Solomon in your text. It is Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, the Song of Songs, just before Isaiah. First, she wants strong character. A wife wants to admire her husband. We see this in the young woman, a need to admire. This is true both before and after their wedding day. In fact, her very first words reflect her admiration. In chapter 1 and verses 2 to 3, she says, "Your love is better than wine. Your name is like purified oil." She cherishes his love for her because she has a deep respect for him. His name refers to his reputation or who he is. His character, she says, was clear and pure like the finest of oils. After their marriage, when the other women want to know what kind of man her husband is, she describes his appearance in chapter 5 and verse 10. She says in chapter 5, "My beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. In a book where images are more prominent than any other Old Testament book, the reader is taken along with them through gardens and vineyards and off into the open fields where his flocks are grazing. The young woman, in a song devoted almost entirely to conversations between the couple, speaks nearly twice as much as the man does, which perhaps would be expected. She is happy and free, probably the most alive and energetic woman in the scriptures. It appears that God, through Solomon, is giving us a glimpse of the heart and soul of a woman. Here in chapter 5 and verse 10, her husband stands out. Among other men, he's a true man, magnificent and yet manly. She sees him as two extremes. He is dazzling, or white as the sun, and ruddy, or a deep reddish tan of the earth. When Samuel first met Solomon's father David in 1 Samuel chapter 16 and verse 12, he is described as ruddy, with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. In short, then, her husband is a handsome man of the open fields. She gives us a long description of him from verse 10 in chapter 5 through verse 16, and she concludes in verse 16, "This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." He was both her true love and her closest companion. He was her friend. A woman is raised or lowered to the level of her husband. She wants to be raised. Though we're not told in the text, we have to wonder if Solomon isn't writing about what could have or should have been true in his life. Dr. Patterson concludes in his commentary on the Song of Solomon that Solomon is writing about his first love. One of the purposes of the song is actually to give us a sharp warning. The day will come when we will either write about what should have been true in our lives or what actually was. The choice is always ours. Solomon started well, but he was like a brilliant medical doctor who blesses the world with a cure for cancer, only to die himself as an alcoholic. He was gifted by God with more wisdom than any man, only to be overtaken by his own foolishness. Solomon concluded in Ecclesiastes 12:1, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth." As you and I grow older, we need to do what it takes to one day write about what has been rather than what should have been. If Christ delays in coming, we want to be able to tell others about the love we won and cultivated with our wives. Again, Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 18 says, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in or with the wife of your youth." David Harrison, in a book entitled Song of Songs, writes a letter to himself. He writes it at a time of confusion and perplexity in his marriage. Here's his letter. "David," he's writing to himself, "love demands courage, pain, a brave response. And while circumstances allow some people to demonstrate courage in extreme ways, most of us are simply called to be brave as we face the problems of each new day. Marriage is like that. Great acts of courage are practiced through the more simple deeds of patience, forgiveness, and kindness. Their reward is rarely sung in the present, but with the passage of time, they are spoken of with words like strength, honor, and goodness." This man understood that a description of a man's character in the future will be a sum total of his smaller deeds in the present. A woman wants to admire her husband, and corresponding to that need, a man has a deep desire to be admired. Just read the sports page. To be respected and looked up to. This is affirmed by Paul when he discusses the responsibilities of husbands and wives in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 33. "Each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband." God has made a man, he's designed a man to grow and change through his need for admiration. A good wife brings out the best in a man. The second quality a woman needs in a man after strong character is leadership with love. She wants to be led. Over the past four decades, the idea has taken a lot of heat. Social architects have informed us that a woman only wants to be led because she's been taught to follow. But such is not the case. A woman responds when a man leads in a Christ-like manner. We see this in the heart of the young woman from the very beginning. In the fourth verse of the first chapter, she says, "Draw me after you and let us run together." Other versions say, "Draw me after you, let's hurry." These are not the words of someone being pressured to follow. She's ready to go anywhere with the one she admires. The key to her future husband's leadership would be his love, and she wants others to know it. In chapter 2 and verse 4, she says, "His banner over me is love." His love flew over and covered her like an impressive banner. In the book of Numbers, we read about the sons of Israel camping around the tabernacle by the standards or banners of Judah, of Reuben, of Ephraim, and Dan. Banners were used to encourage, establish, and regroup armies. In the English language, the word standard was first used as a flag raised on a pole as a rallying point. Back in the year 1138, Richard of Hexham was deeply moved at the sight of a mast taken from a ship supporting the standard of his country and positioned on the battlefield. Later, and this is the first usage of standard in the English language, later, when he wrote about what he'd seen, he called it the Battle of the Standard. Remember, I said at the onset that humility was the first of two qualities found in a rare woman. In this woman's heart, his love flew over her like a banner for the whole world to see. The key to a man's leadership is found in his love. The banner meant security and stability, inspiring and cultivating her humility. And in the preceding verse, chapter 2 and verse 3, she adds another picture to the same idea when she says, "Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. In his shade I took great delight and sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste." Humility. She has no trouble placing herself under his shade. Notice the loving words that are mixed with his invitation for her to follow him in chapter 2. He says in verse 10 of chapter 2, "Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along." And again in chapter 2 and verse 13, "Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along." Names are important in the song. If you take simple Bible study, if you title one side her titles for him, his titles for her, make your list as you read through the text, you find several things. One, that with a rare exception, they had unique and individual names for each other, and each with its unique and individual meaning. Here, both the man and the woman have a set of particular names for the other. "My darling" is used 9 times and only spoken by him to her. 6 times it's combined with a reference to her beauty, as in this passage, and the remaining 3 with a poetic reference to her beauty, as in chapter 2 and verse 2, when he says, "Like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens." He always speaks of her beauty. In addition to darling, the word is translated in several ways, "my love" or "my dearest." It comes from a verb meaning a companion or a special friend, to have and to hold. Abigail Adams enjoyed a very close relationship with her husband, John Adams. She wrote a letter to him on March 31st, 1776, while the principles that would govern this country were being debated. In addressing the position of women in the new country, she concludes her letter by writing this: "Regard us then as beings placed by Providence under your protection, and in imitation of the Supreme Being, make use of that power only for our happiness. So what does a woman need from you? Strong character, loving leadership, and finally, the third quality a woman needs in a man is a passionate faithfulness. She wants your devotion. The wording's strong, a passionate faithfulness, but the passages we're about to read demand it. In chapter 1 and verse 7, she speaks to him as, "You whom my soul loves." That's what she says to him, "You whom my soul loves." And then four times in chapter 3, she describes her beloved in what most expositors call a dream as him whom my soul loves. Let me read that passage, chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. Alone at night and prior to her marriage, she longs for him. Her marriage isn't going to take place until chapter 3 and verse 6. But chapter 3 and verse 1, "On my bed night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him but did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him but did not find him. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me, and I said, 'Have you seen him whom my soul loves?' Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him and would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me." For men to understand their wives, they have to realize a very significant and important truth. The life of a Christian woman is bound up in two men. First, in the man who bled and died on the cross for her and now lives to make intercession for her. And second, her heart is bound up in the man she gave herself to on the day of her wedding, the very day she began to rehearse in her mind when she was a small child. This is why when a man fails to live with his wife in an understanding way and to honor her, we read in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 that God will not listen to that man's prayers. He made her as she is, and he loves her absolutely. You husbands, likewise, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with a weaker vessel, since she's a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, who, incidentally, Paul said, took along a believing wife with him. So Peter knew something about living with a woman. Or listen to the conclusion of Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 5. When a man takes a wife, a new wife, he shall not go out with the army, nor be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year, and listen to this, and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken. That was law. A woman wants to know that after God, her husband loves her above all things. This is probably the most important factor in a marriage. Even when a couple is struggling, the courage a husband shows as he patiently communicates his love day by day makes all the difference. She wants to be close and has a deep longing for closeness. This is echoed throughout the book, but most vividly in three verses. The first, prior to marriage, she says in chapter 2 and verse 16, she says, "My beloved is mine, and I am his." And again, after marriage in chapter 6, verse 3, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine." In chapter 7 and verse 10, she repeats it, "I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me." Marriage is a unique relationship of mutual ownership. Paul concurs at this point in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 4. The wife does not have authority over her body, but the husband does. And likewise also, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. She belongs to me, and I belong to her. I said that a true woman is marked by humility. She's also marked by strength. Not a dominating strength, but one that facilitates the relationship. A true woman is God's tool in the life of a man to bring holiness to daily life. We see this as she makes a final appeal to her husband for his full devotion in chapter 8 and verses 6 and 7. And let me go through that passage with you. It's chapter 8 and verses 6 and 7. First off, she asks for a central place in his thoughts and in his actions. She says in chapter 8 and verse 6, "Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm." An engraved stone or metal seal was used to mark ownership of a person's valued possessions. She wants to be his most valued possession. That's what she's saying. I want to be your most valued possession. Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. She wanted to have her name written on her heart and his arm, the source of his activity and strength. And it should be, because as we'll see in the following passage, love will either lift a person up or destroy them. In obedience to Christ, a man must choose to live with only one woman in his heart, and she must be his most valued treasure. She uses three pictures to make her passionate point. The first comes in the second half of verse 6. "For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord." Marital love, then, like death, is final. Jealousy here does not have a negative connotation. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Just as God is a jealous God, it's used in the same way. God is a jealous God when it comes to what he owns. The woman is saying love is jealous when it comes down to what it owns. You own me, and I own you. Marital love is final and cannot be shared, period. Her second point in verse 7, first half of verse 7, she says, "Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it." When a man elevates his wife in his heart, devoting himself to her alone, their love cannot be overcome. God has designed the marriage relationship to withstand the elements of a hostile world. Let me repeat that last point. We live in a day when people are afraid of marriage. Models, good, healthy models of a marriage relationship are few. Many people enter in with fear. God has designed the marriage relationship to withstand the elements of a hostile world. He's made it that way. Two people who love Jesus Christ can make it. And third, in the last half of verse 7, her third picture, "If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, or in exchange for love, it would be utterly despised." Love is priceless. Money can buy fabrications or substitutions for love, but not genuine love. And since it can't be bought, it has to be given. God gives it as a gift. A man gives it to a woman, and a woman gives it to a man. It's a gift. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her." In conclusion, the Song of Songs shows us what a close relationship between a man and a woman looks like. It shows us both the high value and the hidden beauty of a virtuous man and a virtuous woman in love. What I've done today is to introduce the character qualities revealed in the song that enable a couple to remain close. The book has much more to say. If you're married, read it with God and read it with your wife. If you're not, read it with God. Until that day, when we understand all things, may our marriages demonstrate a closeness that is a fitting example of the relationship between Jesus Christ and his church. Amen.